Hello there. You're listening to the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition is for the 25th of August, 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by sightloss charity Beacon Centre. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods: calling 01902 213 210, visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Cheers for that, Simon. Reading this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Craig, Liz, Helen, Katie, Simon, Angela, Liz, and of course, we have Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country. We have the quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger, an article about mental fitness, the weather, Craig's Black Country joke book, information about the Black Country Plan entering its consultation phase, sounds of nature, and rounding all that off, we get to hear Graham Fisher's In My Opinion. However, we start with our Guess the Sound quiz. I'm going to play a sound clip, and all you have to do is simply guess what it is. So, here's this week's clip. Have a think on that, and Mina will reveal the answer later, alongside the usual quiz answers. We start as always then with some local news, brought to us by myself, Rob, Angela, Liz, Ed, and first up, it's Christine.
More than 70 houses are to be built on land where toxic waste was dumped, despite a four-decade campaign to protect the area from development. The former landfill site bordering Bourne Street and Cedar Avenue in Woodset and Dudley was filled from the early 1950s until the mid-1980s and has been of interest to developers since tipping stopped 35 years ago. Previous bids to build on the site were refused in 2005 and 2011, but now plans to construct 72 homes have been approved by Dudley Council despite concerns over the levels of toxic waste such as arsenic, zinc and asbestos. Potential risks of underground fires, congestion and increased traffic and flood risks have also been raised. Out of eight councillors who attended the planning meeting last week, five voted in favour and three against the scheme. Two letters of objection were sent by Conservative MP Marco Longhi, who has been criticised by fellow Tory and leader of Dudley Council Patrick Harley for opposing developments which are needed under government housebuilding policy. Councillor Adam Aston, the Labour representative for Upper Gornal and Woodset and Ward, said, "This site has been labelled a brownfield development, but let's call it what it is, a huge crater in the ground into which were tipped huge quantities of domestic and industrial waste. It is a contaminated and harmful mountain of detritus from an era when safety standards were far lower than today." Councillor Patrick Harley, the Conservative leader of Dudley Council, said, "Developing this site is a crucial part of the Black Country Plan. I am disappointed both councillors and parliamentary members are jumping up and down to oppose this planning application. We have to develop brownfield sites, otherwise there will be even more pressure on our precious greenbelt. They cannot have it both ways."
Councils across the Black Country in Staffordshire laid off hundreds of staff last year, costing taxpayers nearly £10 million. Between them, the four Black Country authorities and Staffordshire County Council paid out £9.88 million in redundancy payments to 363 workers in 2020-21. It marked a 22% fall in the number of staff laid off from the previous year, with redundancy payments reduced by 55% in figures that are likely to have been impacted by the pandemic. The figure comes amid warnings that council job cuts were likely to continue as successive governments had not prioritised local authority spending. The majority of councils have seen significant reductions to staff numbers over the past decade, although the cuts slowed in the past year due to them focusing on the pandemic. New data from the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government shows that Sandwell Council spent £2.6 million on redundancy packages for 79 employees, while Walsall Council laid off 88 staff at a cost of £2.1 million. Staffordshire County Council and Wolverhampton Council each paid out £2.3 million in redundancy payments to 44 staff and 83 staff, respectively. Meanwhile, Dudley Council, which made £583,000 in redundancy payments to 69 staff, had one of the lowest overall averages at £7,801. The Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government said councils are best placed to make decisions, but that the government is still committed to tackling excessive exit payments. A spokeswoman added, "Severance pay is the responsibility of individual councils, and we urge them to ensure that payments reflect value for money to the taxpayers who fund them."
People in a suburb of Wolverhampton say they like living in Penn and want it to stay that way. They have launched a petition to express their dismay at the prospect of boundary changes pushing them into other parts of the city. Penn councillor Celia Hibbert has organised the campaign after proposed changes were agreed by the Local Government Boundary Commission for England. The changes would see addresses on Colway Road moved into inner city Graiseley. Meanwhile, Goldthorne Hill, Waverley Crescent, Marlbrook Drive and Cotton Road would be transferred into Blakenhall. Councillor Hibbert says she did not agree with the decision, arguing that Graiseley and Blakenhall did not have greater community linkage to the addresses than Penn. She said, "I just feel disheartened as it does not make a difference to what they're looking to achieve because the average electorate ward in Wolverhampton is 3,175. The changes they are proposing don't make a significant change to the ward, but will have a significant impact on the residents themselves who live on these streets. As a councillor, I've represented my residents and clearly they are not happy about it." The Local Government Boundary Commission for England said it welcomes feedback. A spokesman said, "We are carrying out an electoral review of Wolverhampton, which we are doing because of inequality in Wolverhampton. What that means is that some councillors represent more people than in other parts of the authority. The stage we're at in Wolverhampton is we're consulting on some proposals and would encourage local people to give us their views on the proposals, as we take local insight very seriously and quite often make changes as a result. Residents are asked to get in touch by September the 6th by emailing reviews@lgbce.org.uk or online at consultation.lgbce.org.uk.
Councillors are asking for a rethink into the Black Country plan, claiming residents are confused by mixed proposals to development. The Black Country Plan, first drafted in 2017, aims to identify land suitable for regeneration and to provide housing and employment opportunities across the Black Country. It also aims to protect Greenbelt land from developers. The government projects the Black Country will need over 76,000 new homes over the next 20 years. It also needs 560 hectares of land to accommodate new jobs by 2039. This is equivalent to 835 football fields. Councillor Judy Foster, Deputy Leader of the Opposition on Dudley Council, has called on the Council to suspend consultation on the Black Country Plan. The call follows continuing confusion over which sites ought to be included in the proposals. She said, "By the time the consultation started on Monday, I had already been provided with incorrect information regarding which sites were to be included three times. I began getting calls from residents about conflicting information within the online documents and how difficult they are to navigate. Other wards are affected too. Residents are already concerned about proposals to sell off their precious green spaces, and now the consultation process itself is proving to be unfit for purpose. It is totally unacceptable, and Dudley residents deserve much better. Councillor Patrick Harley, leader of Dudley Council, said, "It's incredible that two Labour councils with the same plans and timetable move ahead without any issues, yet here in Dudley we have such an ineffective Labour group that cannot even understand documents their own frontline spokespersons helped put together." Shadow Labour Regeneration members attended the majority of meetings that put the documents and timetable together. It's also unbelievably naive of Councillor Foster to request a delay. Any delay just continues the speculative development of our green belt, which Labour say they wish to protect.
Wolverhampton is up against 19 other places as it bids to become the UK's next city of culture. The Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport has announced that a record 20 places will vie for the title, which is contested for the fourth time and is currently held by Coventry. Joining Wolverhampton are other cities including Bradford, Derby, Southampton, Newport in Wales and Stirling in Scotland. Other entrants have taken advantage of the contest being opened up to regions and groups of towns. They include Cornwall, the Welsh areas of Powys, Conway and Wrexham County Borough, Lancashire, Great Yarmouth, the Scottish Borderlands region and Armagh City, Bainbridge and Crevanion in Northern Ireland. The Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport says the contest uses culture as a catalyst for levelling up areas outside London, with entrants tasked with proving they can put culture at the heart of their plans to recover from the pandemic. Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden that the record number of entries was a testament to the huge success of City of Culture in generating investment, creating jobs and boosting local pride. This prestigious prize creates a fantastic opportunity for towns and cities to build back better from the pandemic, and I wish all bidders the very best of luck. Wolverhampton Council leader Ian Brookfield said, "Winning the accolade had the potential to fast-track our city's growth, international profile and reputation. Since becoming City of Culture, Coventry says it has attracted more than £100 million in capital investment to support cultural projects, as well as also receiving £15.5 million in government funding." Now it's time to hand over to Helen, who has for us this week's Beacon Update.
Hi everyone, it's Helen, back with an update about all things Beacon. Although this week, we're starting with news from our friends at the Black Country Sight Loss Council. You may have heard that on August the 27th, they're going to be holding a Meet the Buses event at Wolverhampton Bus Depot. It's going to run between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. and it's aimed at visually impaired people across the Black Country who use buses to commute. They've joined forces with National Express to give you the chance to walk through the layout of different bus styles, chat to drivers and training managers about your experiences, and discuss how changes can be made to improve the accessibility of buses in the region. You can drop in any time on the day. You just need to head to National Express West Midlands Wolverhampton Garage, and that's on Park Lane, Fallings Park, Wolverhampton, WV10 9QG. I'll give you that once more. It's National Express West Midlands Wolverhampton Garage, Park Lane, Fallings Park, Wolverhampton, WV10 9QG. Next up, we've so loved celebrating the stories of our amazing supporters in part of our Heart of Beacon campaign, and we've got another for you today. Last year, we were lucky enough to speak to Wynne, who lived at Beacon Court before she sadly passed away earlier this year. Wynne had been a Wren, and she'd shared with us some words of wisdom about struggles with the pandemic, telling us to hope for the best, as it was all we could do. So that's exactly what we did. And the best, that's all of our wonderful supporters came through to help us. Wynne's granddaughter, Victoria, recently raised money for Beacon with a raffle, sharing that moving into Beacon Court 10 years ago was the best thing that my grandmother could have done. She'd reached a stage in life at 87 where she had no confidence to go anywhere unless she had company. The support from the team and activities that Beacon provided literally gave her a new lease of life, which was lovely to see. She was able to regain her independence and the social butterfly was reborn. Wynne and Victoria's kindness will always be remembered as their names will be added to our Heart of Beacon mural at our centre, along with anyone who donates this month. Our supporters helped us get through one of the toughest times in our charity's history, and we're hoping they can help us once again as we continue to rebuild from it. You can donate to our Heart of Beacon appeal on our website. It's www.beaconvision.org/heart-of-beacon. That's www.beaconvision.org/heart-of-beacon. Another way you can show your support for the Beacon family is with our new merchandise out now. We've got some bright yellow wristbands and pin badges that show the Beacon logo, and they're available in our shops or from our main reception in Sedgley for a suggested donation of £1 or £2. You can wear yours with pride, knowing that funds raised help support someone with sight loss. Our supporters really are the heart of what we do at Beacon, and we're so excited to launch this merchandise for our amazing Beacon family. While we're talking about shops, we're also incredibly grateful for the support our stores have received since they've reopened. Whether you've bought from us or donated to us, we just want to say thank you to all those who have for making a difference for people with sight loss living locally. If you've got some good quality items you'd like to donate, please bring them into one of our stores when they're open. Items left outside not only cause a hazard for people with sight loss, but they often have to be disposed of, costing our charity up to £1,600 a year. Some of our stores have been inundated with donations in recent weeks as well, so if you've got a large amount of items you're hoping to donate, please check with us in advance by ringing 01902 880 111 and option 2 just to check, as we may be short on space. You can find out more about our stores on our website, www.beaconvision.org/shops. That's www.beaconvision.org/shops. That's it for this week. Hopefully, I'll be back to catch up with you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for that Beacon update, Helen. Now we head into some more local news. And starting us off, we have Liz.
Dudley Council has agreed to refund care home top-up fees for concerned families whose relatives were not offered an affordable placement. A local government and social care ombudsman investigation was launched following a complaint from a man about care home top-up fees he paid for his mother's care. The man's mother, who had dementia, was placed in a care home following a fall. At the time, there were no available beds in care homes that would not require the son to pay a top-up fee over what the council agreed to pay for his mother's care. The son said he was happy for his mother to stay in the care home short-term, but would have preferred her to move to an alternative affordable placement in the long term. Because of the pandemic, she remains at the first home and the son is still paying a top-up fee. The council has agreed to apologise to the son and refund the top-up fees he has paid since his mother attended the care home. Michael King, local government and social care ombudsman, said, "Our investigation has found no evidence Dudley Council offered the family an affordable placement with an available room at the time his mother needed to be accommodated. Because of this, the council should not have charged the son for a top-up fee. We published a public interest report about Dudley Council in 2017 concerning similar issues, and at the time it agreed to improve the way it dealt with third-party top-up fees. I am concerned the council has not fully learnt from this, and we have had to issue the second report. I hope the council will now take the learning from these complaints into its long-term practice. The improvements to its procedures it has committed to make should help to ensure this situation does not arise again."
People living near greenbelt sites under threat from developers have been urged to make their feelings known as part of a major consultation on future house building in the region. The consultation on the Black Country Plan opened last week and will last for 8 weeks, giving residents the chance to have their say on where thousands of homes should be built over the next 15 years. The plan will be a major blueprint for future house building in the Black Country and will see sites put forward for new developments. Officials have warned that significant swathes of greenbelt land may need to be sacrificed in order to meet housing targets. Now, a campaign group says it's concerned the plan has not been publicised widely enough to ensure everyone is aware of sites that are under threat, including some that may be on their doorstep. The campaign to protect rural England raised sites including land near Walsall Arboretum and sandhills on the A461 at Walsall as examples. The group said it was concerned locals may not be aware of the threat to their countryside or that they need to put in objections to the plan if they are to have a say on what goes on in their local areas. The consultation runs for 8 weeks until October. Mark Sullivan, chairman of the West Midlands Regional Group of the Campaign to Protect Rural England, said, "We are concerned that too little is being done to make sure local residents understand what is proposed in their immediate countryside. It is essential that anyone who may be next door to one of these proposals knows that they need to have their say. We want people to know about these plans now."
Police are appealing for help in returning stolen items worth almost £300,000 to their rightful owners after they were discovered during a drugs raid in the Black Country. Officers seized around 700 cannabis plants at an industrial unit in Amblecote, Stourbridge, earlier this month, but almost found around 250 pieces of stolen property. It includes a number of statues, a bike and a hydraulic lift. All of the items combined are believed to be worth around £300,000. West Midlands police officers have already returned a number of the items found, including two ornamental urns from a pub in Wordsley, musical instruments from a school in Kidderminster, and tools which had been stolen from vans in Birmingham and Wolverhampton. Some of the items still had their owners' details attached, while others were marked up with forensic marking solutions, so police were able to return them to their owners after scanning them with an ultraviolet light. PC Lucinda Boardman from Dudley Police said, "As you can imagine, those people are delighted to get their property back. But unfortunately, quite a few of the items don't have any identifying features on them, so we need your help to get them returned to their rightful owners. Police are expected a lot of people to contact the force in relation to the items, so I've asked people not to ring but to get in touch via the live chat facility on west-midlands.police.uk or by emailing contactus@west-midlands.pnn.police.uk and quoting incident number 1638-170821. Two men arrested on suspicion of cultivating cannabis have now been bailed as police continue with their investigation. All of the cannabis plants have been destroyed.
Concerns have been raised by residents about weeds growing out of Dudley's historic red house glass cone, with calls for action to be taken. Councillor Adam Davies, who represents Briley Hill on Dudley Council, said a number of people had contacted him about the weeds at the landmark. But after meeting with the team at the museum, he said there wasn't a quick fix, as the structure is still set to undergo repair work. Councillor Davies, who posted the update on social media, said a number of residents have contacted me with concerns about weeds growing out of the side of the cone itself. Unfortunately, there isn't a quick fix to this, as the cone is still to undergo significant repair works, and heritage experts have advised that works to remove the weeds before these repairs are done could further damage the cone's structure. That said, I have asked if the weeds can at least be cut back in the meantime to minimise how noticeable they are. Whether this temporary cutting back is possible will depend on the advice of the heritage professionals. In general, it was reassuring to meet with the team and receive an update on overall plans for repairing the cone and securing its future. It is Grade 2 listed and a scheduled monument, so these works will take time, but crucially, the right processes are underway. Although the main area is closed off to visitors, the visitor centre, shop, upstairs gallery, indoor exhibition spaces, studios and Red Cone Coffee House are still open. So, make sure you pop along and enjoy more than a drive past this local gem.
Family, friends and former patients of a much-loved Wolverhampton doctor turned out as a road was named in his honour. Dr. Charman Lowell, who lived in Penn and ran Bradley Medical Centre in Bilston for more than 20 years, died aged 65 in 2018 following a lengthy battle with cancer. The caring GP was incredibly popular in the area and described as someone who would go out of his way to do anything he could to help others. The grandfather was a doctor in and around Wolverhampton for 40 years and hundreds turned out for his funeral, including city MPs. A road in the new Bilston Urban Village development has now been named Charman Lowell Gardens in his honour, following a campaign by former patients and people in the area who knew him. Family members were joined by former patients and local councillors for a special ceremony to mark the naming of the road. Rishi Charman Lal Maman, Dr. Lal's son, said, "It's a privilege for all the family. It's a real honour and it's something that Dad worked hard for, but he would have been the first to say he didn't deserve it. But it's an honour the local community have bestowed on him. It's a real privilege. He was definitely a hard worker, a family man who was dedicated to his job and to the community."
We now hand over to the keeper of the questions. That's of course Mina, who this week has a quiz all based around bread.
Hello and welcome to the Flashback Quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question one. How many does it take to make a baker's dozen? Question two. How many sandwiches are eaten every second in the UK? Question three. What name was given to bread when it was used as a plate? Question four. Where was sliced bread banned in 1943? Question 5. How much bread do we waste in the UK? And finally, question 6. How many types of bread do we make in the UK? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show. But for now, good luck.
Thank you for those quiz questions, Mina. Now we have another block of local news. And starting us first, it's Angela.
A woman stopped her car from being stolen after spotting it being loaded onto a truck outside a Wolverhampton church. The woman, who has to be referred to as Bev, had been leaving a Slimming World session at St Bartholomew's Church, Penn, on Monday when she saw the attempted theft taking place. She told the BBC she saw her car being loaded onto the back of a transporter truck and jumped onto the back to reverse her vehicle down the ramp by releasing the handbrake. The driver fled the scene after a brief tussle with Bev, in which she tried to take her keys. Passers-by stopped and took the number plate of the truck, with Bev saying the incident came a few months after a catalytic converter was taken from her husband's car. A spokesman for West Midlands Police said, "We're investigating this attempted theft. We've spoken to the owner and contacted a local church who may have the incident on CCTV. Anyone who saw what happened but hasn't yet contacted us should get in touch. If you're worried about your car being stolen, visit our website, west-midlands.police.uk, for security advice from the experts."
A Black Country sports stadium is to be twinned with the famous field in Flanders, where First World War soldiers downed their arms for a game of football as part of a tribute to Dudley football legend Duncan Edwards. The Duncan Edwards Peace Field project will also see the launch of a new annual youth football tournament in memory of the Manchester United and England midfielder, who was killed at the age of 21 as a result of injuries sustained in the 1958 Munich air crash. The Dell Stadium at Brierley Hill, home to Dudley Town FC, will be declared the Duncan Edwards Peace Field in a ceremony on November the 11th. It forms part of a worldwide scheme which uses sport as a way of encouraging young people to understand each other better. Organiser Jim Cadman, who has co-written a book about Duncan's life, said civic dignitaries and local football celebrities will attend the event, which will see it join with three other schemes in the UK, honouring football heroes Dennis Law, Tom Finney and George Best. In the UK, peace fields have been created in Preston to honour Sir Tom Finney, in Belfast to honour George Best, and in Dennis Law's hometown of Aberdeen. Law, the only survivor of the UK footballers honoured with peace fields, this week revealed he was suffering with dementia. Teams representing each of the four fields will play for the Duncan Edwards Trophy at the Dell each year. The stadium will be twinned with designated areas of play at the Flanders Peace Field in Messen, Belgium.
Cyclists across the region have been receiving extra protection thanks to a police initiative. The Operation Close Pass initiative by West Midlands Police has seen 185 motorists stopped due to potentially risking the safety of other road users. The action took place between July 29th and August 11th as part of a series of days of action where routes of concern were highlighted in partnership with West Midlands Fire Service and Transport for West Midlands. Around 30 people were reported for driving offences, ranging from driving without due care and attention to driving without insurance. Others were educated around the dangers of not keeping at a safe distance. The operations took place at locations that were highlighted by Transport for West Midlands, including Chester Road in Birmingham, Foles Hill Road, Manor Way in Dudley, Birmingham New Road in Sandwell, Wolverhampton Road West in Walsall and Cannock Road in Wolverhampton. Sergeant John Butler from the Road Harm Prevention Team said, "We want all of our road users to be safe and feel safe when travelling across our region. Operation Close Pass enables us to speak to road users individually and educate them on the dangers of overtaking too close. This includes an interactive input from our fire service colleagues." He added, "In the most serious cases, we won't hesitate to prosecute those who recklessly put lives at risk."
The leader of Dudley Council made the latest visit to a local business as part of a pledge to help businesses come out of the pandemic. Councillor Patrick Harley visited Metallisation as part of his Made in Dudley Borough initiative to help the borough firms bounce back better and bolder after the lockdowns of the past 18 months. Councillor Harley had a tour with bosses from the company, which is based on Pear Tree Lane in Briley Hill and has been trading since 1922, and got to see the firm's business in operation. The firm has been in the news recently for a number of projects, including working with Plasmatrack to revolutionise the cleaning of rail track, and with Rolls-Royce on the revolutionary use of robotic snake arms to help with engine maintenance. Councillor Harley has pledged that the council will do even more to get businesses booming again following a tough year. He said, "People tell us that there are no manufacturing firms in the borough anymore, but here is proof that there is, and they are thriving. Metallisation is not just a national leader in its field, but a global one, and exactly the sort of business we should be championing in our borough."
A Wolverhampton shopping street has become a bouncing and vibrant area since the lifting of coronavirus restrictions. People looking for bargains or wanting a bite to eat or something to drink have been making the trip to Limes Court in Tetnall since restrictions were lifted. The street, which mixes cobble streets with plants and Victorian architecture, has welcomed new occupants over the last year, such as Cataldo's Italian restaurant, which was formerly in Wolverhampton's city centre. Mark Hodgkiss, who owns Mode Menswear, spoke about some of the occupants who had opened up on the street and how business has been since the lifting of restrictions in July. He said, "We recently had George's Coffee House, which is next door to me, open up and replace Café Zest, making it a bit more contemporary. We also had Cataldo's open up here, and they've really done a good job there updating the insides, which has really boosted footfall here. People have just wanted to come out and support the local shops, and that's really helped us, as well as people being really pleased to see we're all still here after the last year." Mr. Hodgkiss said the street had a different feel and described it as a hidden gem. "We've got a lovely cobbled pathway from top to bottom, Victorian architecture dating back to the 1900s, and capstone lampposts, all of which add to the appeal of it. I would say to anyone who hasn't been here to come and take a look, as it has a lot of local businesses and it's got a unique feel which is nothing like anywhere else in Wolverhampton.
Now we have information about the Black Country Plan, which is now entering its consultation period, in which you get to have your say.
Welcome to the Black Country Plan consultation, which runs from the 16th of August to the 11th of October 2021. The Black Country Plan 2039 is the name of the local plan consultation for the Black Country. This is your chance to have a say on how we shape the future of the Black Country by 2039. But what does the plan involve? Every local authority is required by government to write a local plan to set out how their areas will grow over the next 15 years. The four Black Country local authorities of Dudley, Sandwell, Walsall and Wolverhampton have a joint plan which sets out where and when new development will happen in the area. The existing plan was approved in 2011 and will soon become out of date. The new Black Country plan will replace the existing plan and will plan for future growth in the Black Country over at least the next 15 years. But why should you get involved? Once agreed, the Black Country plan will provide the framework to determine future planning applications, some of which will be in areas where you live and work. The new plan will include development for new housing, schools, health facilities, transport links, and places to work will also be supported. But how much development does the Black Country need? The government projects that the Black Country will need just over 76,000 new homes over the next 20 years. To support this growth, we also need 560 hectares of land to accommodate new jobs by 2039. This is the equivalent to 835 football fields. The Black Country Plan provides a spatial plan to show how this growth can be met in our area, both in our towns and existing neighbourhoods. The plan is at its draft stage for consultation during August to October, giving you the chance to have your say on the proposed sites for development and where you think new development should be in the Black Country. So, how do you get involved? You can find the Black Country draft plan and have your say online at blackcountryplan.dudley.gov.uk. These documents are also available to view in some council reception areas and in some libraries. Thank you.
Now we enter our final block of local news, brought to us by Christine, Angela, Ed, and starting us off, it's Liz.
Olympic boxing hero Ben Whittaker has achieved his dream of becoming the mayor of Wolverhampton and used his brief time in the role to further inspire others. The silver medalist from Darlaston said he wanted to become the city's first citizen following his quarter-final victory in Tokyo, a request granted on Sunday. It saw him wear the mayoral robes and follow correct ceremonial procedure as he was taken on a tour alongside the current mayor, Councillor Greg Brackenridge. Councillor Brackenridge, a former boxer himself, was more than happy to grant the Olympian's wish and even got to wear the silver medal and test himself against the pro. "I feel like royalty," Ben said, as he put on the ceremonial robes. "This is a dream come true," he added, as he was given the mayoral chains through the proper procedure. Ben, summing up his time as mayor of the city, said, "It's a dream come true for me. I kept on saying when I was a kid that I'm going to be the mayor, and the dream is a reality. Truthfully, I said it as a bit of a joke, but it's happened and it's been a really good day. The Olympic medal has a lot of weight behind it, and I was surprised by how light the mayoral chain was. I was scared I was going to break it when I was sparring. A lot of people are inspired by me and what I've done, and I was buzzing to see people and meet them and let them hold the medal. Ben was later invited down to Molyneux for Wolves versus Spurs, along with Councillor Brackenridge, at the invitation of club chairman Jeff Shee.
Tickets have gone on sale for the Kazoo Grand Slam of Darts taking place in the Black Country later this year. The event, which attracts top darts players, will be held in Wolverhampton's Alderslea Leisure Village from November the 13th to the 21st. The prestigious 9-day tournament features 32 players who initially compete in 8 groups before a knockout phase sees the stars challenged to win the Eric Bristow Trophy. The Grand Slam has proven highly popular in Wolverhampton since being introduced in 2007, with the legendary Phil Taylor claiming 6 wins in the event before his retirement. Michael van Gerwen picked up 3 straight titles from 2015 to 2017, while Gerwen Price won back-to-back Grand Slams at the Alderslea Leisure Village in 2018 to 2019. Last year saw Portugal's José de Sousa claim a remarkable win as the event took place behind closed doors due to the pandemic, and he will defend his title in front of fans in the return to Wolverhampton this year. Councillor Steve Evans, Wolverhampton Council's cabinet member for events, said Wolverhampton is the spiritual home of the Grand Slam for darts, and we've been proud to host this event for the past 14 years, welcoming the best darts players in the world and their fantastic, passionate fans, who create an amazing, fun atmosphere. We are delighted to have them back after the unavoidable gap last year due to COVID. This is all part of our overall 5-year event strategy to bring the very best in art, music and sport to the city to boost the local economy, create new jobs and build an outstanding cultural reputation.
A 12-year-old girl from Cradley Heath has been selected as one of 40 finalists taking part in the Junior Miss British Isles model competition. Lily Summer Cadman, a pupil at Ormiston Forge Academy, holds the title of Junior Miss West Midlands and will take part in the national final, which is being held at Chester Racecourse on September the 4th. She gained her place from thousands of young girls aged from 9 to 12 seeking the chance to win £1,000 cash prize, as well as clothes, photo shoots, introduction to leading model agencies and other prizes. Lily Summer will be up against finalists from across the British Isles. She will be one of 40 finalists taking part as representatives of different areas of the country and will be judged on facial features, hair and personality. She said, "When I heard that I'd been chosen from photographs submitted to the competition, I was running around the house and was very excited. I'm really over the moon to be chosen to take part." Sue Cadman, her 53-year-old grandmother from Old Hill, said Lily Summer will have to take to a catwalk as part of the judging. She had said that she wanted to be a veterinary surgeon, but earlier this year she told me that she wanted to try modelling. I think the idea came to her after moving to senior school. Until recently, she had no aspirations to do modelling, but for her birthday in April, I bought her a photo shoot. I'm very proud of her achievements, as she is my only granddaughter and is the only girl in our family unit.
A young businesswoman from Wolverhampton is cooking up something good to tempt the taste buds of both customers and judges in a national competition. Grace Ripperlow, aged 22, has always enjoyed baking, and while in her third year at Coventry University reading economics, she found herself at home because of the COVID-19 pandemic. She decided to set up her own business, GG Desserts, with a shop on Etsy selling brownies and blondies online. Now her business is growing, she has decided to concentrate on her baking instead of accountancy, despite gaining a first from university. Grace will be one of 75 finalists for a Young Traders Market national competition to be staged at Stratford-upon-Avon on August 27th and August 28th. She said, "I started the business in November last year while studying. I love baking and thought that I would do something while stuck at home during the pandemic. I thought it would be a good way to contact people on social media, and after a few months decided that I would take the risk and concentrate on my baking and set aside plans to go into accounting. Now I am constantly baking and making about 100 brownies each week, which sell for £11 to £16 for six, including free delivery. I have also started doing local markets to get my name known to people and a wider market. For the competition, I will be baking more than 1,000 brownies in a 4-day space to sell at the market at Stratford-upon-Avon.
A brave black country woman scaled the O2 Arena in London to raise money for a cancer charity after losing her mother and grandmother. Tracy Spicer Neal, aged 49 from Wolverhampton, trekked up the 164-foot high building in aid of Macmillan Cancer Support. She lost her mother Sandra to breast cancer during the coronavirus pandemic. Her grandmother also died of breast cancer. Tracy completed the challenge on August the 11th and has raised more than £800 to date. The idea to climb the O2 began in 2015 when Tracy and Sandra visited the attraction as part of an Elvis exhibition. She said, "When we got there, we noticed people were climbing up the building, and Mom turned to me and said she really wanted to do it. So on August the 11th, I did it. Once I got to the top, I raised a toast to my mum. After the day, I am completely tired and blisters on the balls of my feet." She added, "I chose Macmillan because Mum used to support Macmillan with a monthly donation." Jana Kawa, fundraising manager for the charity, said, "It seems that fundraising for charity runs in the blood of Tracy and Sandra. I've heard that Sandra often used to support local charities, doing things like dressing up and participating in annual sponsored walks, and now Tracy is picking up the baton. We couldn't be more grateful to Tracy for choosing Macmillan, and we really hope she has a head for heights. The money raised will help us to fund more healthcare professionals in local hospitals."
Now we head over to our very own Flashback Roger, who, as always, has for us a bunch of amazing facts.
Hello again, everyone. Here I am with this week's episode of Curios, although the subject this week is all about bread, and you can't get a more basic everyday item as that, can you? I love the smell of baking bread or toast. Anyway, off we go then with this one. Now, I'm sure that most of us know that a baker's dozen is a phrase that means 13 items. But did you know that the practice comes from medieval times when bread was sold in small loaves, most often in standard dozens of 12 pieces? Some loaves were lighter than others because bakers tried to rob on weight or because of different weights of ingredients. Not all dozens were equal. Strict laws were made that required bread to be sold by weight. By adding an additional loaf to the dozen, customers were getting weight by the law. Every year in the UK, around 12 billion sandwiches are eaten. That means 380 every second. And believe it or not, the automatic pop-up bread toaster was patented before the bread slicing machine. In medieval times, bread was used as an absorbent plate. It was called a trencher. And after the meal, trenchers could then be eaten, given to the poor, or fed to the dogs. There is a theory that pizzas come from a trencher. Within 5 years of the invention of a machine for making sliced bread, 80% of bread sold in the USA was sliced, although pre-sliced bread was banned in the US for a short time in 1943 as a wartime conservation effort. Bread is the food that we waste the most. In this country, we throw away 32% of it, which means one in three slices go straight into the bin. This happens even though we're pretty good at checking to see whether we need more. Now that's a weird one. I wonder what's going on there. In this country, we make more than 200 types of bread, from traditional British recipes to exotic types from abroad. 50% of bread consumption is accounted for by the not-so-humble sandwich. Oh, we do love a good sarnie in Britain, thus paying homage to the Earl of Sandwich, who is said to have invented it in 1762. In Road, hopefully, this week's Did You Know spot didn't go too much against the grain, and that it didn't find you loafing about. I hope that at yeast you found it interesting and not too crusty. I do promise to try butter next week, but for now I'll say bye, I'm off to have some toast, and I'll bet it lands butter side down if it slips off me plate. So wish me luck. Ta-ra a bit. Ta-ra.
Thank you for those fantastic facts, Roger. Up next, we now have Mina, who has for us a weather update.
The weather for this week is going to be very sunny and dry, with some early reports suggesting temperatures could rise further, bringing with it a heat wave. However, temperatures are currently predicted be steady throughout the week, typically hovering around 20 degrees. UV levels are expected to be moderate to high throughout the week. The sunrise and sunset times are 6:17 a.m. for the sunrise and 8 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday 27th through to Sunday 29th of August, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 20 degrees. On Monday 30th of August, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 20 degrees. On Tuesday 31st of August and Wednesday 1st of September, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 20 degrees. And finally, on Thursday 2nd of September, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 19 degrees. So that's your forecast for the week. As always, enjoy the weather.
Now we have our ever popular Sounds of Nature feature. This week, we have an uninterrupted recording of a riverside atmosphere recorded at the Mill in Dunsford, Devon. This recording was made by Lawrence Shove and was made available by the British Library. Now we have the latest football news from Wolves and West Bromwich Albion. Albion made it 3 championship wins on the spin by beating Blackburn at Ewood Park. In what was another impressive performance by Valerian Ismail's side, the Baggies took the lead inside the opening 60 seconds, thanks to an outstanding volley from Alex Mowat. Matt Phillips then doubled their lead just before the break when he tapped home a cross from Carlon Grant. Blackburn pulled the goal back after the interval though, through Ben Berriston. But Albion missed a host of glorious opportunities to make their win more emphatic. Grant and Darnell Furlong all hit the woodwork, while Rovers keeper Thomas Kaminski made a string of fine saves. In the end though, it didn't matter, with the Baggies securing the win that means they've taken 10 points from their opening 4 games. Albion's next league game sees them travelling to London Road to take on newly promoted Peterborough. Off the pitch, Albion could be forced to reassess their striker options after Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola insisted young forward Liam Delap would be staying at the Etihad this season. Delap, the 18-year-old son of former Stoke, Sunderland and Derby midfielder Rory, has been targeted by Albion as well as a number of Championship and European sides, as a potential loan signing ahead of next week's transfer deadline day. It had been thought that the highly rated teenager could be made available to speed his progression into men's football. And with Manchester City chasing the signing of Tottenham and England centre-forward Harry Kane, Delap was thought to be likely to be loaned out to get a taste of first-team football. However, with Spurs chairman Daniel Levy standing firm in refusing to let Kane leave North London so far this summer, Guardiola said he is likely to hang on to Delap. "He's going to train with us if a striker comes or doesn't," the City boss said of Delap. "He's going to train with us all season." Wolves failed to make their attacking dominance count as they fell to a 1-0 home defeat to Tottenham Hotspur. Much of the pre-match chat was about Bruno Lage's first home game in charge and the return of former boss Nuno Espirito Santo. But on the pitch, Wolves were buoyed by a loud home support. Dele Alli came in to ruin that party atmosphere, however, when he picked himself up off the floor to convert a penalty after 10 minutes. From that moment, though, Wolves dominated. Adama Traore was a constant menace and created several big chances that the hosts struggled to convert. The Spanish forward then missed a glorious one-on-one chance in the second half as the game got away from Wolves. In the end, their display deserved at least a point, but in similar fashion to the week before, they could not make their opportunities count and were condemned to defeat. On Tuesday, however, Bruno Lage earned his first Wolves win after a dominant display against Nottingham Forest put them through to the next round of the Carabao Cup. Buoyed by a loud away following, Wolves controlled the game from start to finish as they attacked at will against a weakened Forest side low on confidence after a difficult start to their Championship season. But for all their dominance, Wolves struggled to find the back of the net in the first half and saw several good opportunities squandered. The game threatened to get away from them in the early stages of the second half, but after finding their composure and regaining possession, two quick-fire goals put them in control. Both strikes came in the space of 2 minutes, as Romain Saïss met a short corner routine to tap home, before Daniel Pedence made it a goal-scoring return from injury with a neat finish. Forest made some attacking changes in an attempt to get back into the game, but found it difficult to get hold of the ball, before Wolves added a third through Francisco Trincão. Wolves were not done there though, and quickly added a fourth through Morgan Gibbs-White to earn their first win under their new boss. Wolves are next in action this Sunday against Manchester United, playing at home this Sunday. Now we hand over to Mina, who has for us a piece on how to keep our minds active and healthy.
Everyone has the occasional senior moment. Maybe you've gone into the kitchen and can't remember why, or can't recall a familiar name during a conversation. Memory lapse can occur at any age, but aging alone is generally not a cause of cognitive decline. When significant memory loss occurs among older people, it is generally not due to aging, but to organic disorder brain injury or neurological illness. Studies have shown that you can help prevent cognitive decline and reduce the risk of dementia with some basic good habits. Staying physically active, getting enough sleep, not smoking, having a good social connection, limiting alcohol to no more than one drink a day, eating a Mediterranean-style diet. Memory and other cognitive changes can be frustrating, but the good news is that, thanks to decades of research, you can learn how to get your mind active. There are various strategies we can use to help maintain cognitive fitness. Here are several you might try. Number 1. Keep learning. A higher level of education is associated with better mental functioning in old age. Experts think that advanced education may help keep memory strong by getting a person into the habit of being mentally active. Challenging your brain with mental exercise is believed to activate processes that help maintain individual brain cells and stimulate communication among them. Number 2. Believe in yourself. Myths about aging can contribute to a falling memory. People who believe that they are not in control of their memory function, joking about senior moments too often, perhaps are less likely to work at maintaining or improving their memory skills, and therefore are more likely to experience cognitive decline. Number 3. Prioritise your brain use. If you don't need to use mental energy remembering where you laid your keys or the time of your dentist appointment, you'll be better able to concentrate on learning and remembering new and important things. Take advantage of smartphone reminders, calendars, and planners. Design a place in your home for your glasses, purse, keys, and other items you use often. Number 4. Repeat what you want to know. When you want to remember something you've just heard or thought about, repeat it out loud or write it down. Then, that way, you reinforce the memory or connection. For example, if you've just been told someone's name, use it when you speak with them or her. So, Sally, where did you meet Jagdeep? Number 5. Space it out. It's best not to repeat something many times in a short period, as if you were cramming for an exam. Instead, restudy the essentials after increasingly longer periods of time. Once an hour, then every few hours, then every day. Spacing out periods of study helps improve memory and is particularly valuable when you are trying to master complicated information.
Thank you for that very informative piece, Mina. Up next, we head over to Craig, who has for us his Black Country joke book.
Hello, I'm Craig. I'm going to tell you some jokes from your Black Country joke book. I was in a pub in Gorner, and the barman said to me, "I've not seen you for a while. How's you been?" I replied, "Fine, mate. It's round the back garden where I usually keep it." Here's another one for you. Someone in Wolverhampton High Street started talking to me and she mentioned Doris Day. So I said to her, "Doris Day? I never said she did." And finally, I walked into a Dudley pub and I saw a moody looking bloke standing on his own with his dinner on his head. I said to the barman, "What's all that about?" And he replied, "Oh, don't mind him, he's just got a cob on." I'm Craig, and that was my Black Country joke book.
Thank you for those jokes, Craig. And coming up next, we have Mina with the answers for this week's quiz.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Have you risen like a perfect loaf or fell as flat as a pancake? Let's find out. Question 1. How many does it take to make a baker's dozen? And the answer is 13. Question 2. How many sandwiches are eaten every second in the UK? And the answer is 380. Question 3. What name was given to bread when it was used as a plate? And the answer here is a trencher. Question 4. Where was sliced bread banned in 1943? And the answer, the USA. Question 5. How much bread do we waste in the UK? And the answer here is 32%. And finally, question 6. How many types of bread do we make in the UK? And the answer here is 200. How did you do? Great, I hope. But if not, there's always another chance to have a go next week. Now, did you get the answer to this week's Guess the Sound question that Rob asked at the start of the show? Here's one more chance to hear it before I tell you the answer. The sound you just heard was the recording of people playing table tennis. Now, to end this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, we now head over to Graham Fisher for another edition of In My Opinion.
Hello.
Auntie Beeb does it on Radio 4. Why shouldn't I? So, here's my thought for the day. Does science always hold all the answers? Now, I'll just let that one burble in the background whilst I expand upon my reservations. If I have lusted over a lifetime in cultivating my passion for Epicurean pleasures, then there is one that has been my mistress since I was 18 years old. Ah, how I recall the first time I fell for the seduction of usgi, as it's pronounced in Celtic, or as we more usually refer to it, whisky. More specifically, malt whisky. Allow me to explain both the circumstances and the distinction. There I was, enjoying one Friday evening with my dear late father. We were like brothers, and Friday was our evening, when we ventured into the Britannia, an inn close to what was then home, and sought a tipple of something a bit different from the usual fare to titivate our palates. "Ever had one of these?" inquired our genial host, pointing to a bottle labelled Blair Athol. Dad and I sipped a nip each and glanced at each other euphorically as our eyes rolled heavenward in sheer pleasure. Here was unalloyed hedonism, unbridled decadence, quintessential bliss, all in a glass. And from that, you may gather, we were smitten. Mine host gently prodded into our reveries and explained this was proper whisky, reserved on the top shelf for the connoisseur, not the mass-produced blended stuff held upside down on the optics. As an aside, this was our first experience of pure Scottish malt whisky, from the only bottle of pure Scottish malt whisky on the premises, since in those days few made their way much past the border. How things have changed in the interim, where my local corner shop now has an entire shelf buckling under the stuff. But back to my tale. Mine host explained that, unlike, say, vodka, that can be enjoyed as soon as it emerges from the still, whisky has to be made under strictly controlled circumstances, and, as he poetically intoned, not a drop can be sold till it is 3 years old. We knew he wasn't kidding. It was written on the bottle. Well, that did it for me, and I was, excuse the pun, intoxicated, fascinated by this magical potion. So, to cut to the chase, I put my nose to the grindstone, did my homework, and within a short time thereafter had written several articles, droned on interminably to anyone who would listen about my investiture, and compiled a presentation, in those days on overhead acetate projection slides, that I hawked around decades before the advent of computerized PowerPoint. The intervening years have seen me undertake visits to manifold distilleries, and joy upon joy, for a significant birthday, my 60th, my good lady took me on a trip to become intimate with several of my mistresses, as together she and I undertook masterclasses on every distillery on Islay, off the west coast of Scotland, and home to my favourite brands. Fate also played its part, and when we relocated to the Welsh border, we found ourselves just a few miles from the Penderyn distillery in the Brecons. Its tale, and a fascinating one at that, involving a descendant of the founding father of electricity, Michael Faraday, who made the unique still, is for another time. But it was following another visit there just a few days ago, coupled with an item I coincidentally heard on the news, that spurred me to reminisce. Before I do ruminate further about an alcoholic quaff, there are those who might suggest I should offer the usual caveats of drinking responsibly, etc., etc. But to the genuine aficionado, this would seem somewhat incongruous. To partake in an appreciation session is akin to being a member of a devout order. There's a tranquility and reverence for the Holy Spirit. A glass containing the merest dampening is first swirled in the base and observed for clarity, brilliance, sparkle, colour and depth. depending on the strength, commercial whiskey sold at 40 degrees proof, cask strength may be approaching 70. There may be discussion as to whether it requires cutting by the addition of fresh spring water or sampled neat. No ice, please. The temperature shock can radically affect the compounds. Sacrilege, in my opinion. But then again, though purists may disagree, I tend there is no right or wrong way on how to enjoy your snifter, and I have engaged in many debate with them on the merits of that one aspect alone. Whatever, malt whiskey is the only spirituous liquor known to man in which the addition of water entirely transforms the perception. Try for yourself. Pour a shot of gin and put water in it. Result, it tastes of watered-down gin. Now consider, let's say, one of my favourites sitting on my shelf right now, a 12-year-old Kalila. On its own, this is a robust cask-strength spirit, reeking heavily of carbolic and phenols. Put it into a shot glass in which just the teensiest measure of spring water has been swirled around and thrown out, leaving just a residue on the wall, and wow! Smell it. Nosing it is called, and see if you agree with the accompanying tasting notes that suggest fresh, herbal, rubbed peppermint leaves, stemmy damp grass, smoky, oily, cigar leaves, smoked ham, hickory, lemon peels at the harbour. Lemon peels at the harbour? What? It's a very intimate personal thing, is this whisky tasting, which is its allure. Swallowing the stuff seems almost ancillary, since it only confirms what you've already gathered from the look and the nose. But if you do elect to roll the majestic liquescence gently around the mouth and onwards towards the throat, those same notes suggest palate, good body, oily, tar, elegant smoke, hints of boiled sweets. Finish, long, peppery, spicy warmth, smoke. A bottle of this quality could set you back hundreds of pounds northwards, so the last thing you want to do is gluttonously over-imbibe. Hence, no need for nanny state sobriety caveats. One is hardly likely to have a night out on the town swigging it indiscriminately. The real deal, eh? What's the difference? Well, the secret of whiskey goes back to the days when the heavenly liquid was distilled in pot-shaped vessels hidden away from the loathed excise man. Rabbi Burns was once one such, and before becoming better remembered as the Scottish bard, he unknowingly walked across the town centre over concealed pot stills on his way to work. The time-honoured pot still of Celtic lore was laborious and worked on one batch in, one batch out. The arrival of the patent or coffee still, named after Aeneas Coffey, an inventor born in Dublin in 1780 and who, like Burns, was once a surveyor of excise, heralded the era of mass production. Ireland was a world leader in whisky making. The coffee still was an arrangement of two fractionating columns from which spirit could be produced continuously, and its introduction to Scotland had a profound effect on the indigenous industry. Seeking to capitalise on a combination of pot still quality and coffee still efficiency, the enterprising Mr. Davidge mixed the two brews together and sold the product as Scotch whisky. He picked the wrong fight, and the uproar from the industry in Scotland was as predictable as it was tumultuous. It led to the Royal Commission on Whisky and Other Potable Spirits of 1908, which set the standard in a law that is still extant, in essence. It defines Scotch whisky as a diastase of sacrificed malted barley distilled in Scotland and matured in oak barrels for a period of not less than 3 years. Note, this is Scotch whisky. Let me not digress into the difference between this and that produced elsewhere, why whisky is sometimes spelt with an E, or how its expression, i.e. its age and proof, and its manufacture varies. The Japanese can't get enough of the stuff, and a testament to their ingenuity in producing it is the range of excellent spirits that are a long way down yonder from their production in the 1970s of a little lamented mark named King Anne. But to be called Scotch malt whisky, it has to be aged for at least 3 years in oak barrels, and it has to be made in Scotland. That's the law. thinking back, I can't recall tasting many Scotch whiskies that are just 3 years old. And those that I do, I remember, were light, precocious affairs. But, as always, it is a question of personal preference. Ditto the variation between Highland, Lowland, and Island that is readily identifiable to even the most innocent of taste buds. To offer an idea, imagine a line drawn from Greenock to Dundee. Anything below is a lowland and above is a highland. Look at the terrain on a map and note how the lowland hints at a soft heathery background, whilst the highland is indicative of a hardier offspring. The island malts, my darlings, are robust to the point of being almost chewable and are characteristically noted by the smack of peaty soil and salt-tanged air of the rugged coastline. The differences between whiskies are sublime, and for sure there is a malt to match every inclination. The time spent in the barrel is what defines the depth and character, and something between 7 to 25 years is preferable. Anything over 35 years may be subject to deterioration, and there's always the loss by evaporation through the wood, the angel's share. And no, it doesn't mature in the bottle. Ah, but enough. How could I endlessly wax lyrical about this spirit that has given me so much pleasure for so many years, and of which James Hogg, the Ettrick shepherd, said, "Thence to the belly the fire passes." Clearly, it was not water I had drunk. It was life. So, as to my initial postulate, does science always hold all the answers? Well, listening to my radio this very morning, I hear that scientists have discovered a method to evaluate a whisky's provenance by way of laser analysis. Can't have it whisky has become big business, but similarly, a genuine whisky can wane over time, rendering it a considerably less of value. Hence, the long-sought imperative for a means of assay, which now, thanks to the wonderful advancements of science, can be analysed and quantified by means of laser analysis through the bottle. Et voila. The composition can be identified and the quality can be assessed without so much as popping a cork. All very impressive, I'm sure. But reflecting on a lifetime of active research, as I reach for my favourite Stourbridge crystal decanter and hand-cut tumbler, I think I know a much better way. Cheers.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!